You are listening to The Reverse Stick, the Global Hockey Podcast, and it's time once again for our featured interview. And Matt, our guest today.
Yeah, so we've got Stephen Findlater joining us today on the show, primarily to talk about the EHL within his role there as the media officer at the Euro Hockey League. And he also does lots of other interesting things with hockey, and we're going to really struggle, I think, to just keep on the subject of EHL because there's lots and lots to talk about. So first off, welcome Stephen to the show.
Cheers.
So Stephen, first off, explain to us what your role is with the EHL.
Yeah, so basically I'm the media officer, so I look after the website of the competition, and then basically looking to promote it in whichever way we can with the, you know, the various different platforms, obviously Facebook, Twitter, social media, and Instagram and things like that. And then also working with all the clubs, we provide them with all the nice graphics and things like that that you might be seeing from a number of the clubs over the past couple of weeks, the European clubs that are taking part in the round one, which gets underway on Friday in Barcelona.
Certainly, it was very professional and sets a really great image for the sport. For those that don't know, can you give us a little bit of a background about what the EHL is, and what's the story about the EHL?
Yeah, well, the EHL, it started about, we're into our 11th season of the Euro Hockey League. It's basically meant to be like a Champions League, which I'm sure is probably fairly well known from soccer terms, that kind of version. So it's 24 clubs from around Europe battling it out for the Alain Danet Trophy, to be crowned the best club in the European competition. So we start off with the round one of the competition, which starts this weekend in Barcelona. We're going to have 12 clubs there playing in four groups of three. The winners of those four groups of three will then go through to the KO16, which is the way where the real business end of the competition gets going. It's going to be 16 teams there battling it out in straight knockout matches. And then they go through to obviously the KO8, and then that's all going to take place in Rotterdam next Easter. And then we have the final four, which is going to be at Whitsun weekend, which is going to be in late May. May 26th and 27th, where the top four side play the semi-finals and the finals. So there's 12 different countries taking part. So we have three teams each from the Netherlands, Germany, and Spain, and Belgium. And then from the next tier down, we've got two teams from England, Ireland, France, and Russia this year. And then then we've one side each from Wales, Scotland, Poland, and Austria this year. So, all 12 of those countries will be represented at the round one in Barcelona, and that kicks all off on Friday morning.
I take it, Stephen, these teams have qualified through their own home leagues as finishing through either some knockout competition or a proper, you know, season league. Is that right?
Yeah, so all national champions from the top 12 the top 12 nations currently ranked in Europe, they all get their spot in there. And then afterwards, when it comes to the Dutch and the Germans and the Belgium, it's based on performance each year. So how each team performs in the EHL determines how many teams they'll get in the next season's competition, so to speak. So like if, you know, you got the Dutch tend to be far and away the strongest each year. And, they tend to have a lot of sides that reach the final four of the competition. That means that they've got three places in the competition. It changes a bit from year to year as things go down. So currently the Spanish and the English are battling it out for the, between sort of fourth and fifth in the ranking list. And then that will determine whether they have three or two places in the competition. And after the national champion, it's down to really the respective federations, how they decide to divvy up the places. So, I mean, a lot of the leagues over here will have playoffs at the end of the season. So if you win your regular season, you'll probably get one place for that. And then the national champion is going to be who wins the playoffs as well, will probably be the other one. If they're the same team, then it can be either the runner up in the final or some other variation of that. Some teams have, some of them have various different playoffs techniques for that. So but pretty much you are picking the elite sides from all the different countries around Europe.
I did notice we had a unique situation this season with Surbiton turning down their spot.
I think the first time in the history of the EHL that somebody's actually turned down their spot. Basically, Surbiton is their London-based club, and they've got quite a few England internationals. But in addition to that, they've also got quite a few Welsh and a couple of Scottish ones. And then with the Commonwealth Games pretty much being, I think it's 2 weeks after the EHL takes place, I think they felt that they basically weren't going to be able to use the first team squad that they'd be using all the way through the season to be taking part in the EHL, and they didn't feel they'd be competitive. And so they decided to take a step back. As a result of that, it meant that there was a bit of horse trading between Wimbledon and Holcombe, the next two in line from England. So Surbiton won the national championships. Wimbledon qualified as the next place side in their rankings there. But as a result, they were given the option whether they wanted to actually go to straight through to the KO 16 or to remain in round one where the second seed was. They decided to remain in round one, and so Holcombe, who are the next best placed English side, they went straight through to the KO 16, despite finishing third in the English competitions in their rankings. So, yeah, a bit of a coup, I think, for Holcombe.
And they'd be happy with that.
Yeah, I'm sure they. Stephen, you mentioned there that the top 12 countries in Europe can take teams from the top 12 countries. And I can understand why, certainly in the beginning of a competition like this, you need to have some sort of boundaries and try and make a solid base to work from. But would you consider that in the future you'd be extending that to other nations within Europe, of course?
Yeah, well, I mean, over the course of the history of the EHL, I think there's been 16 different countries have taken part. I mean, so the ones who are sort of ranked between 9 and 12, there's, you know, if they don't perform in the competition, then it'll kind of, it'll open up a spot for somebody from, say, Switzerland or the Czech Republic, at the moment are quite close in terms of overtaking them. So, you know, that's always a possibility. So there is, it's open in terms to all clubs to potentially qualify depending on performance. Are you talking there about sort of maybe extending the competition out to about 32 teams or something like that? Is that the?
You could open up another two places and have a second tier club competition where those, you know, whoever finishes one and two or something goes through. Just the idea of it, you know, giving other countries an opportunity, other teams.
Now that system currently exists. I mean, basically we have at the moment is the Euro Hockey Trophy, and then there's also the Euro Hockey Challenge competitions. So there's, I think, at this stage about four or five different regional competitions or European competitions for clubs all the way down. So basically, you know, how you perform in, say, the trophy competition, if you finish in the top two in that one, then you can get extra ranking points for your country, which will then, you know, give you a better chance of qualifying for the EHL, and then sort of all the way down. I mean, so there's an they're all 18 competitions for the most part, except for the bottom tier, so the fifth tier in Europe, which will have, you know, anywhere between 5 and 10 teams or something like that, depending on entries. But every country all the way across the Europe gets the potential of having two European club competition club entrants during the year. And so as a result of that, like there is that kind of movement up and down. So I mean, you have Ireland there who've got two sides in the EHL this year. I think it was only 3 years ago they didn't have anybody involved. Just basic previous performances haven't been very strong, and they had to pull their way all the way up through the different divisions to get promoted into the EHL. So yeah, there is that movement up and down between different countries. Yeah.
So it's similar ranking to the FIH system, points wise, and the performances of your national side have got nothing to do with it, but it's individual club performances within those competitions can then garner points for the wider national association.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, each game that you play in the EHL will have points. So for each game that you win, you'll get a points total towards your national rank, your national ranking. So like basically, if you're Bloomingdale, you win both your games fairly comfortably. You get your 12 points, which you carry through onto the national rankings. Then you'll add that to whatever, say, Rotterdam get in the later rounds of the competition. So each game is important in that kind of way. So, I mean, you'll have in the build up to this weekend, Cardiff and Met, they're Welsh representatives. So last year they were the first Welsh side ever to, first of all, the first Welsh side to ever qualify for the EHL by their performances in the Euro Hockey Trophy. And then they picked up the first ever win for a Welsh side in the EHL last year when they beat Amsicura from Italy. And as a result of that, it meant that, you know, even though they didn't qualify through to the KO 16 stages of the competition, they were delighted with the performance because it meant that they were probably going to stay within the remit of the EHL for another season. And so, yeah, their coach and their captain, Walid Abdo, and then their player, Luke Hawker, said that pretty much that that's their target this year. They can pick up another win against the Russian side, Dinamo Electrostal, then that would probably represent a good campaign for them because it means that they get to the top level of competition for another year and then gain that bit of extra experience.
Yeah. Now, whilst you mentioned Cardiff and Met, do you want to give us a quick rundown on the sides that were involved this weekend with the opening round in Barcelona?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, so I mean, I suppose we'll start then with that. Cardiff and Met are placed in Pool B. They're in with Ullenhorst Mülheim, who are they were nine-time champions of the old European Cup back in the 80s and 90s before the introduction of the EHL. So they're pretty much European club royalty. They're back in the competition for the first time in about I think it's 3 years since they were last involved. They've got some world-level players like Tilo Strzałkowski is the captain there, but they are going to miss Benedikt Furk and Lukas Windfeder, who are both injured at the moment. Both players who are fairly well healed in the German national team. So they'll probably be the fancied side in Pool B. Cardiff and Met will be probably the outsiders. They have a decent amount of players from the Welsh national team, but their problem is that they actually play, bizarrely enough, in the English league, a bit like Swansea and Cardiff in football play in the Premier League in England. Yeah, Cardiff and Met have kind of gone beyond the Welsh leagues and gone into the English league structure and are actually in the second tier. So they always struggle with getting competitive matches leading into the EHL. So they're going to have a bit of a fight against them. They're playing against Dinamo Electrostal is the other team in that group, and they're the Russian runners up who just finished up their Russian championships last weekend.
So
I suppose the most exciting group looks like Pool A. You've got Bloemendaal, who are pretty much European royalty. I think most neutrals probably will have come across them at some stage. They're two-time champions of the EHL when Jamie Dwyer and Tone Denoyer used to be in tandem together a few years back. Jamie Dwyer, I think you mentioned on your show a few times a couple of weeks ago, he's back in Bloemendaal. Whether he plays or not, we don't actually know at this stage. He only actually landed in Holland about 2 or 3 days ago with his family. So whether he's fully up to speed with Bloemendaal at this stage and whether he's going to get a spot in the squad for this week remains to be seen.
There's a game of hockey going. He's playing, I would imagine.
He's always worth having just for that 5-minute cameo.
So there we go. The other big... A big team in that pool is actually Wimbledon, from, as we mentioned earlier. Wimbledon are, pretty strong outfit. They reached the final four of this competition, last season. They were the first English side to do that since 2011. Since then, they've added, some really, really big players like, Ian Lewis, and Ali Brogdon, who are, two fairly well-heeled players that are going to give them an extra bit of pace in attack with Brogdon and then, quite a lot of composure at the back from the GB squad from the last couple of Olympics from Ian Lewis there. The third team in that group is SV Armenien, who are from Austria, the record Austrian champions. I think they're the outsiders, but their player coach, fairly interesting guy called Darius Rakowski, he's a Polish guy. He's been there 3 or 4 years, and he really, really loves this competition. And about 2 or 3 years ago, He helped the side get through to the KO 16 for the first time, the first time an Austrian side had ever done that, at this very same venue when they stunned the Athletic Trasa home crowd by managing to pick off a draw there and then beating the Scottish side Kelburn. And whilst he realises his side is probably going to be fairly outgunned at this point, I think he looks at it as a good learning opportunity, and he fancies a bit of a shock in this one. Pool C is the Belgian third place side Racing Club de Brussels, who, few fairly good names in there. Tom Bone, Cedric Charlier, Connor Hart lining out for them. So they're a fairly strong side. They'll be the favourites. They've got Banbridge, the Irish Senior Cup champions, as the next side in there, who did actually beat Belgian opposition to top spot in their group last year, Royal Leopold. But I think Royal Racing Club de Brussels are probably that bit stronger this time around. And Banbridge have weakened with a couple of their players being signed up in the wake of their good European run by clubs in Germany and England. And then WKS Grünwald Poznan close out Pool C. They're the one of only two clubs who played in every single season of the EHL. They're the Polish champions. They've won it, I think, 20 out of the last 21 seasons. They're the military club, so they're I think they struggle a bit domestically for top level games, and so the EHL is one of the things they really target each year. And finally is Pool D, which the home side, well, the de facto home side, Club Igara. They're not playing at their home stadium. They're based about half an hour up the road in Terrassa, but that's Club Igara. They're led by Pau Quemada from the Spanish national side, who's the key man there. They've also re-signed Vincent Ruiz, who's returned after a couple of years in Holland from HGC. So that's a big signing for them. The other two teams in there are from Scotland, who've topped the table in the Scottish League, I think, for the last 13 seasons or something like that, on and off. And then Saint-Germain from France, who are the French runners-up. So that's the lineup for this weekend.
Stephen, it sounds like a great competition. You mentioned all those great names that we know from world hockey, but very often competitions like this aren't won by your best three or four players. They're won by your bottom three or four players and how much you can get out of the lower end of your list. Disregarding those sorts of big names, who do you think's a real chance to win?
Over the course of this weekend, I think there's probably a good amount of favourites there that, you know, you're looking at Bloemendaal are probably the ones from here who can probably go on and progress through to the KO16 quite well. Either them or Wimbledon will make a bit of an impact in it. And then Mülheim in Germany, I mean, one of the features for them, as you mentioned, the bottom three, is that they've been carrying about six or seven injuries so far this season, and yet they're still sitting quite high up in the German league after about five games. They've got four wins out of six or something like that, and kind of pushing for the playoffs again at this early stage of the campaign. So, yeah, I mean, it is very much a nature of the squad game. I mean, all these sides are just pushing for a place in the knockout stages in the KO16. What we're looking at then is another 12 sides will come into the fray next Easter, and from there, yeah, it's very much a wide open game that you've got loads and loads of good sides. The reigning champions from last year are Rot-Weiss Cologne. Again, their side very much packed with superstars, in terms of Christopher Ruhr and Mats Grambusch. But yeah, they one of the reasons that they did win actually last season is that wider squad. I mean, the key players in the final games tended to be the ones that were from their under-21s. Florence Colton scored one of the crucial goals in the semi-finals. I don't think he played more than seven or eight games for the senior squad. And when they went out and beat, one of the other sides in the weekend was KHC Dragons, the Belgian champions. They were only working off a squad of about 13 players for most of the tournament weekend, and they really struggled in the latter stages of each game. So like that, you know, the differences between the top end of the teams and the bottom end can be that distinct. And so, you know, whereas in international games, you're going to be playing with your full 16 outfielders and, you know, whereas these guys, a lot of the time, they can just be, you know, bringing guys on for just like 5-minute spells, you know, and then and making all those changes. Whereas at this level, you will have the reduced amount just working off 13 or 14, and so other things come in as a factor.
I guess the other dynamic with it is as well that you've got sides like Dinamo and Elektrostal coming off the back of their season, and sides like Banbridge not having too many games under their belt at all.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it's the nature of the Russian winter. They've moved in the last 2 years to being a calendar competition, calendar year competition to starting in, they start pretty much in May and go through till October as it gets pretty cold around those parts during the winter. Whereas Banbridge, they've had a complete disaster of a preparation. And I think you've had a conversation with on Twitter with a few people about the umpiring situation in Ireland, where they lost the first two rounds of their league matches to an umpire strike, effectively, as they argued over expenses and things like that. It meant that they just had one build-up match so far, one competitive build-up match leading into this. So their coach Mark Tumulty is a bit concerned about whether their prepared enough for the competition. And yeah, they didn't have a particularly tough opening league game as well. They played against a Railway Union side that would, that's shy quite a few decent players this season. So yeah, there is those differences in the level that you come into the competition with. I mean, yeah, and it varies. I mean, you've got Bloemendaal once again. They've had some seriously tough competition in their opening four or five league games, where they've played two or three of the other sides who will be involved in the shake-up for the Dutch playoff mix at a very kind of elite, elevated level. Whereas you've got Armenen in their group, who played a 12-0 win against a side, Modeling, in one of their early ones, which obviously doesn't give a huge amount of competitive hockey to their preparation.
Stephen, you mentioned there the Irish umpires. I'll get back to that in a second with you, because I figure by your accent you might know a little bit more than what we do about the whole situation. Going back to what you said at the beginning about a soccer-style Champions League, not the same thing, but in that vein, one of the Champions League in soccer has become an invaluable tool for a lot of clubs to attract players, and also it's a financial boon for them. We see that teams will put out better sides for their Euro Championship games than they will for their home leagues if they have a game coming up. Now, it's obvious what's in it for players, a competition like that. What's in it for the clubs that are involved? Is there something that clubs are getting back out of it as well?
I mean, first of all, there is prize money for the winners and then the runners up and the third place, and also for the top goal scorer and things like that. So, which, yeah, it isn't overly widespread in European competitions. So there is that. I mean, one of the things though is, I think it's just one of the things that the EHL has managed to do is raise the stakes in terms of a fan experience, particularly at the KO16 and the Final Four. I mean, you probably, you know, one of the things you'll see quite a lot of the time is, you know, the packed stands at the knockout stages of the competitions, and then you'll see, you know, the flares and the real colour of the different supporters groups and things like that. So that's one of the things it's really generated that way, and I think the players then feed off that, you know, that you know, sort of, you know, you've plenty of kind of club games in your own country and things like that, where you won't get that giant crowd and things like that, whereas this is a, you know, a new level to showcase your skills in front of. I mean, for someone like who's playing for Armenen, you know, from the smaller clubs, if you're going to come up against Bloemendaal, I mean, you won't get too many times in your life that you'll get to line out against Jamie Dwyer, maybe, you know, putting a few decent tackles in on him or something like that. So, like, for the smaller clubs, it's that. Whereas for the bigger clubs who are pushing on towards the latter stages of the competition, there is, you know, there is that, that sense of doing it for your local community and things like that. I mean, when I'm trying to remember the quotes were from last year, but you know, you have Matt Scrambush playing in the same side as his brother and things like that, you know, guys that they've grown up with. I think Morris First, I did an interview with, he spoke about how he played with Uatse Hamburg from the age of four and was probably on the sidelines from it when he was the age of one, and this is in relation to a Hall of Fame interview that when he's been inducted into the EHF Hall of Fame, he said that, you know, playing with the guys that he sees every day, every week, you know, all the way around his local area, you know, was something really, really special, you know, amid all the Olympic Games and the World Cups that he won, that he felt that this was, you know, a real passion of his. So, you know, there is that kind of thing that really, that the players really, really love being part of.
So, with regard to, you talk about the fan excitement and the involvement of fans, for somebody like SV Armin, if they were playing against Bloemendaal, what kind of numbers would that look like on home soil if it was a game in Holland? 4,000, 5,000? What are the sort of the crowds you'd expect to see?
The KO16 last year in Oranje Road in Eindhoven, we had, it was sellout crowds of, I think we had 5,000 to 5,500 for each of the 4 days of the competition. In previous years, when Bloemendaal hosted the KO16 about 3 years ago, they had 7,500. It sold out for the last three of 6 days of competition that we had. We actually combined the KO16 and the Final Four together. But yeah, you had up to 7,500 there. So there's, I think over the course of last season, we had 30,000 people coming to various different games at the various different rounds and things like that. So yeah, there's a, you know, a decent crowd experience for these ones. It's going to be on a much smaller scale in Barcelona this weekend, but, for the latter stages of the KO 16 Final Four, you'll definitely bring a good few thousand.
The benchmarking's interesting on the capacity size. You know, the Hockey Pro League coming up, that you need to have a 4,000 capacity stadium to be able to be a host facility for it. And it's funny, you look at, I think with the record hockey crowd was it 70 or 80,000 at Wembley for England against the USA, late 70s, something like that. And Terry Walsh spoke about maybe playing in front of 90,000, 100,000 in Pakistan. It would be great if we could get ourselves back to those kind of numbers.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You laugh, is it fanciful?
Well, I mean, I'd love to see it happen. I mean, it, at the moment, just the numbers are that bit more modest. I mean, we're at the European Championships in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago, the place was absolutely rocking, but certainly, you know, sort of much closer to the kind of the 10,000 mark. And it was, you know, it was an incredible experience, the way that they put together all the presentation of the games, all the extra bits, the extra entertainment during halftime shows. And, you know, the hockey was pretty special as well, you know. But I mean, at the moment, like, especially in the kind of club environment which we're dealing with here, I mean, a lot of these clubs, I mean, they've got a finite amount of space. I mean, we're looking at Dragons, who are one of the clubs in Belgium who are very, very good hosts, but they had to remove a number of trees around their grounds to accommodate the World League semi-final a couple of seasons ago when they hosted it, and even then it was still, that brought it up to about, I think, 13,000 or something like that was the capacity. So in terms of if we're to do it at club venues, then there is a probably a finite amount of space for a lot of these places, but at the international level where they're going to be building more and more purpose-built stadiums, yeah, hopefully we can build much bigger venues. And I mean, there's quite a few of them going up in India at the moment, and hopefully we do get those numbers again.
Yeah, one of the great things that I love out of viewing EHR games and a lot of the bigger European games is that crowd passion and the fact that we've got, in inverted commas, ultras for certain clubs, and there's a few flares going off and some group chants. And I think it's something, you know, we get a bit bored sometimes with the golf clap around the side of the pitch and well done. And it's certainly at club level, at our club, when we get together as a group, we can make some noise and get behind our team. But I've been watching a little bit of the AHL this week, so it's state versus state. And it's still, you know, a mild ripple of applause around the ground, and there isn't that passion and fire in the bellies that you get from club hockey. And when we spoke to Bernardo Fernandez earlier on in the year, he was talking about, I don't know whether Hockey Pro League is the way forward. He thinks the way forward is through club hockey and through systems like EHL.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. He's a good man, Bernardo, and he's got some really progressive thoughts on the game. So yeah, I'm delighted he thinks that. Yeah, I mean there's certainly a big, you know, strength in having that kind of identity with a local club, and where you've grown up, the people that you've seen all your life and all that kind of stuff to stoke the passions. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this is, yeah, I mean, the Dutch crowd certainly in Holland creates a huge amount of noise for their international games as well, and the Belgians. But I think beyond that, I mean, going to some other events around the world, it can be, you know, it can be fairly quiet in the venue. So it's certainly something that, the EHL really, you know, does try and promote. I mean, when we do the supporters information that we send out, you know, we do give just the guidelines on, you know, the use of flares and things like that. It's not a case of these things are illegal, you know. It's just that we like to put it out there that these things are, you know, that they are allowed, and make sure that we generate the best atmosphere possible.
Yeah, I like your towing the company line there. It's superb stuff, Stephen. Yeah. Thank you.
I must admit, Steve, we would have a problem with that in this country, because if you light a flare, you soon find yourself on the Channel 7 news being singled out, and social media goes ape shit at you, basically. It's just not the done thing here for some reason.
But it's also a bushfire thing as
well. There's all sorts of weird reasons for it. But can you see your model being internationalised, the European Hockey League becoming an international style competition? Do you think hockey as a sport can do that, or do we have too many boundaries to us? You know, international, the whole, is it too big a sport to try and do that, or does soccer actually show us the way?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. I mean, I suppose you're looking at the way the different countries are set up. I mean, you know, in Australia you've got a club system there, but I mean, in some of the other big centres like India and Pakistan, that, you know, a lot of the time it isn't club based. It's based on the teams would be run by, you know, sort of corporations or sponsors and things like that. A lot of the banks would run teams and things like that, and then it would be based on, you know, your state system and things like that. And then again, similarly in Malaysia. So it's difficult to kind of see how that would kind of tally in with them. You know, I mean, like in India, there's so many sort of different centers, where the hockey is big, you know, sort of Bhubaneswar, which is going to host the World Cup, is pretty much out in the limb on the east side of the country in Odisha with not much around it. So, you know, it'd be hard to see how that develops there. But I mean, you know, you could certainly see it in various different places like sort of Argentina and Australia and then New Zealand being able to form, you know, different things. But again, from New Zealand, I see they recently had their, well, not completely au fait with it, but I see that they had the Ford League was on again last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and again, finals.
And then, so they're all going, that's on a sort of a regionalized basis rather than the club basis. So, yeah, I'd love to see it. I do think it can, you know, stoke the passions by going on the club side of things and focusing on that. But sort of Europe is probably the best place to do it because it's, you know, so many small countries with full hockey leagues available to them at a reasonably kind of competitive level. So, yeah, I'd love to see it, but I'm not too sure if it's feasible in some of the other hockey centres.
Stephen, so often we're told that India is the country for hockey, the population, the players, and the history of the game there, etc., etc. But is Europe actually really where hockey is at the moment?
I think, you know, I've been to a couple of events in India, and it's sort of It seems to be a regional kind of thing, if you know what I mean. In Bhubaneswar, there's a huge amount of passion in the small town there in Odisha. But when I went to events in Delhi, it really depended on what part of the city you were actually in, if anyone was actually interested in hockey. So in Delhi for the World League Round 2 a couple of years ago, there was maybe about 50 people in a fairly decent sized stadium. So it's kind of, you know, it's difficult to know, you know, like if you go to the wrong venue, so to speak, over there, if you're going to get that huge amount of passion. Whereas, I mean, I think we're at this stage now that we're 11 years in with the EHL, you know where all the kind of the points where you'll definitely have a big crowd that are likely to come. I mean, it's pretty much around the Dutch clubs and the Belgian clubs who are going to bring, you know, huge numbers. I mean, and things like that. And there's definitely and then you also get that in probably around London and stuff like that as well. I'm probably going a little bit off track there with the question, but yeah, you know, it is fairly concentrated around Europe. I mean, you will see, you know, some of the Dutch clubs, I think in recent weeks just went and played sort of pre-season friendlies that midweek just after work. Some of the lads would just drove over, and they drove over to play in Cologne and Mülheim and things like that. You know, that it is very, very concentrated, and you do have a little kind of triangle or a kind of square worth of a huge amount of hockey clubs in a very concentrated area space, which does help promote the game and create that passion.
Yeah, I hadn't forgotten about the umpires, Stephen, just quietly. I'll get back to them now, the Irish umpires. Now, it's very hard for us to tell where we are in Australia, what's going on. The first we heard about the situation was when the umpires said we're going on strike. So can you give us some sort of background to, you know, what led to this action and you know, what's the outcome of it, essentially?
Okay. Well, I suppose the history is, dating back maybe 4 or 5 years at this point. The Irish Hockey Umpires Association had kind of flagged with Hockey Ireland, the governing body for the sport, that they felt they had a ticking time bomb in terms of their, the age profile of the officials in the country. So basically, they had, you know, I think that the numbers have now dwindled to, they've got 120 umpires on their official lists, which for the volume of matches that there are at a reasonably high level which require decent umpires is quite small. And then the fact that there's only under 40, there's only about 30 umpires of that, so only about a quarter of it. So the age profile was a big worry for them. And so basically over the last couple of years, the Irish umpires have they've been putting together sort of development plans and things like that, but they felt that their concerns were completely ignored. And so as a result of that, it came to a head in the last week of August, about 2 or 3 weeks before the EY Hockey League, which is the national league over here, was due to start. And when it came into the week before the season was due to start, then with no movement whatsoever, they decided that they were going to withdraw their appointments. So they weren't going to nominate umpires to go towards matches. As a result of that, Hockey Ireland was left in the situation. They tried to see if they could source umpires through other routes, but this wasn't satisfactory for the clubs, who felt that if they were going to have a non-accredited umpire running an elite level match, that this wasn't a viable situation, as you can well imagine. And so the first two series of matches were cancelled. So the crux of the resolution that's happened, which allowed the first series of matches to happen there the other day, was over expenses, first of all. So initially the umpires would get, if they're doing national level games, they'd get a mileage rate of 20 euro cent per kilometre, which is pretty much next to nothing, and then no other kind of match fee or anything like that. So they felt that this wasn't a viable rate and was kind of indicative of that they weren't getting too much respect from Hockey Ireland. So the resolution has seen that rate rise up to about 37 euro cent per kilometre, but also with a match fee on top of it, about 30 euros. So this obviously encourages the umpires to join up with the Irish Hockey Umpires Association. Previously, you would get full expenses and also much, much greater supports if you stayed in the regional umpiring bodies, like the Leinster Hockey Umpire, which runs the leagues in Dublin and the kind of surrounding areas. And so they were finding that a lot of umpires, it was a lot more attractive just to do local level games rather than doing the international or doing the national level ones. So that's the resolution at the moment. There is still further talks about how they can implement a 4-year development plan to rejuvenate the umpiring stock of numbers and stuff like that. But that'll probably be a lot more long term, but at least we've got some hockey back on the fields.
Do you know why it took, well, not why it took so long, why it happened so late in the piece? Have discussions been going on since the end of last season, or has it just all kind of come up in the past few weeks?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a feeling that it did just kind of happen all of a sudden. I mean, so one of the other things that I do is I'd run the Irish hockey website, hookhockey.com. And yeah, I mean, the first, you know, I got a message through that the umpires had a development plan that they'd put to Hockey Ireland last May or so. They released this around the same time as the national finals and things like that. Obviously times, to get a bit of impact there, but from there we didn't hear a huge amount about it until pretty much August 31st, which was just 2 weeks before the start of the season, and I'll give you the quote from the Irish Hockey Umpires chairman Warren McCulley. Says that there's been total inaction over many months and many years as they failed to grasp the number of opportunities to deal with all these issues. So I assume that basically they presented a 4-year plan earlier this summer, around about that May time, and basically nothing really happened since then. And so they decided that enough was enough, and they weren't going to appoint umpires to games. I mean, from the Irish hockey point of view, I think they felt a bit let down that they took the militant kind of action to effectively go on strike, saying that they felt that they had opened up dialogue, but from their point of view, they initially felt that if they were to effectively raise the expenses level, it would be tantamount to paying umpires, which they previously, the philosophy would be that it's an amateur endeavour. and a volunteer endeavour for people, and that they needed to take this to the members of Irish Hockey, as in the clubs who do the voting at Hockey Ireland events and things like that. But and then this, you know, this late notice meant that there wasn't any time to convene any sort of general meeting. The umpires didn't believe that a general meeting was required, and so then they had that impasse, and it was fairly bitter for a couple of weeks, and no doubt there's probably going to be some lingering kind of stuff from that. It's a fairly major change in policy effectively they're getting expenses rather than being paid, but yeah, there is a feeling that it did rumble on pretty, or it did explode pretty much out of nothing from the general hockey public's point of view.
Yeah, look, and it certainly caught the eye of the hockey world, but hopefully there's some progress being made there now, and we're moving on. I think John's got a little question.
I was interested in the idea that they had that any sport in the modern era was still an amateur sport. That's quite surprising. Do women have the vote on the Irish Hockey Board there? I mean, it seems a bit backward, that ideal.
Oh, the idea of it being the amateur.
Yeah, it's in this modern era. I love the way that they cling to it, but it seems like if you're a leading sports administrator, that's something that you would not be considering in this modern time.
Okay, this is a whole can of worms I think you've opened up now. It's actually quite an interesting one at the moment in Ireland. We have our Gaelic games, Gaelic football and hurling, which are both steadfastly amateur. And now these are games which, you know, I mean, probably not too well known outside of Ireland, but within the island of Ireland, you'll have the finals were there in September. You'd have 82,000 people going out to the final games, and tickets being traded for anything up between, I don't know, beyond €70 up to about sort of 400 or 500 euro and things like that. And yet all the players are 100% amateur in terms of being paid to play and stuff like that. Now, a lot of them will be getting endorsements for different kind of sponsors and things like that, but it's...
Some free sausages from the butcher?
No. I mean, there'd be a few agencies and stuff like that. They'll be getting a couple of grand here and there for personal appearances and things like that. So there is... You know, there is some money to be made there, but only by a minority of players. But it's kicked off because one of the players has had the gall to have a testimonial dinner in his favour, which is for €2,500 a head. And this is the first time that any player has done this. Now, he is a superstar of the game, a guy called Colin Cooper. And now this has opened up the big debate kind of going here. How can he, if he's been an amateur player for the last 15 years, how can he command €2,500 a head for a, you know, and so.
Could be very fine dining.
Yeah. So you're right in what you say when it comes to, you know, the balance of, you know, the claims to be amateur in sporting organizations at this point. I mean, in terms of the umpires, I mean, it's, you know, I think that the feeling is there isn't the level of income, you know, available to that you'd be having forced onto the different clubs. The clubs would then have to, you know, put this back onto their members to charge them further rates and things like that. I think the feeling was that if they were going to make this shift in policy, that it was going to be a fairly big deal for them. So,
It's a situation for them in some ways, isn't it? For the board, I mean, they've got a lot of pressure on them that comes in from outside, a lot of it financial.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the one thing that came out of this was that everyone felt that you really like that they do need to support their umpires more. I mean, obviously it's a you know, regularly said it's been a thankless task. You know, I mean, for especially for the top level ones, that they were getting less things covered for them than umpires at a lower level. So, I think that's what's come out of it, that they need to get, there's definitely a deficit in the amount of support that they're getting at the top level. So, so they do need to get that. Where they get the finance from is going to be the other issue. Now, the way that they've financed the increase in the rates for the top ones is to take it directly out of a sponsorship package from EY, who sponsored the national leagues. Now, the sponsorship there was previously whatever was left over after expenses for the competition organisers was doled out to the different clubs to help them with their travel expenses. So they're obviously going to get less towards their travel expenses. So that's going to be an interesting one about how clubs who will have at this stage already have done their budgets for the season, that they now know that there's going to be a shortfall coming somewhere along the line.
Well, look, whilst you've got the can of worms open and we're on Irish hockey, John picked up a comment last week with regard to a bellicose rump from Ulster Hockey with regard to the All-Ireland League, and we were hoping for some people to get in touch with us and let us know what that may be, but seeing as you're on the line, any ideas?
No. Where did you see this just out of interest?
It was an article that was in the Irish Times website, and by a guy, Johnny. That's the one. And during, and it's a very particularly well chosen couple of words. That's not just something that slips out. Bellicose rump, but he was describing that most people were happy with Irish hockey being a national competition, except for one bellicose rump from Leinster or from Munster.
No, Ulster.
Ulster. Sorry, yes, Ulster. Mm-hmm. You might better not get that wrong.
Okay. All right, okay. Well, that is a can of worms, all right. So,
you want to leave that one alone?
No, we can go into it. So basically there was, where do we start? So first, Johnny Waterson is particularly kind of well-placed. He's a former international. He played a pretty high level with the Irish team. Various different tournaments and stuff like that. He's originally from Belfast, where he grew up in a GAA background, so playing football and hurling and stuff like that, but only took up hockey when he moved to Dublin, which is, you'd normally go probably the other way around if you were to make these kind of, these kind of moves. But anyway, what he's referring to there is basically there was quite a tight vote basically in terms of actually introducing the EY Hockey League, the All Ireland League, for the first time. It's only this year's only the third season of it, and the sticking ground was basically all the clubs in Leinster, all the clubs in Connacht, and all the clubs in Munster were all voted in favour of it, whereas the Ulster Hockey Union decided the overarching body for the clubs in the north of the country that they were going to get the opinions from their own members themselves and then kind of impose a vote from their members. And then this so a lot of the clubs up north who didn't really feel like that they wanted to be part of this, the All-Ireland League decided that they ended up being in the majority up north, and they gave the Ulster Hockey Union what they felt was a mandate to go down to the meeting and a vote against the prospect. Now, it kind of shot themselves in the foot in the end, because the clubs who actually, you know, it's one vote for a club. Per club, so there's, you know, I think what about I think 95 to 100 clubs I think who were eligible to vote, and then one vote for each province. So what this did was it had to be a 75% majority to pass the vote. So all the teams from Munster, Connacht, and Leinster who turned up for the vote, they all got their one vote. They all put it in. I think only one dissenting or something like that from there. Then the Ulster vote came in, and it was just one vote against them. And the other clubs stayed away. The clubs from the north who were actually interested in playing in the EY Hockey League, they did come to the meeting and then did put the vote in, and then it ended up passing by, I don't know, something like about 86% or something like that, whereas 75% was the pass rate. Whereas if the clubs who were actually against it came down and voted themselves, then it probably wouldn't have gone through. So that's probably the bellicose rump that they're referring to, you know.
Those clubs would have the individual choice. If they wanted to take part in it, they could do. If they wanted to stay in their provincial leagues, they could do that.
Yeah, I mean, so in the top league this year, Cookstown got promoted to the top level of the competition this summer. But in the wake of when in the playoffs, their coach Stephen Cuddy he basically said, look, we'll take this back to the club and we'll have a think about whether we actually want to go up. He felt that sort of the previous year they'd got relegated, and then when they went back into their Ulster League, they got more matches. Basically, there's more local domestic cup competitions, stuff like that, less travelling around the country. And so he wanted to weigh up the pros and cons about whether this was actually, you know, better for the club to have a team playing in the elite level that their club fans didn't get to see week in, week out. So, they're very much weighed up now. They did take up the option of going up, but, it does kind of, you know, even if they, you know, so even if they voted against it, they would have had the option. They wouldn't, nobody would be forced to go into the National League if they didn't feel they had the resources to do it. So, yeah.
So I guess we'll just move on our Irish roundup, which is good to hear. The European Hockey Federation had their meeting over the past couple of days or last week, and there's been a resolve with regard to the under 21 situation and the Spanish sides getting Nova virus. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, that's actually as full disclosure, I was the EHF media officer at that event over in Valencia at the time. So it was a fairly interesting day all around when we were actually staying in the same hotel as the Spanish under 21s with ambulances coming in and out through the night and stretching people off to the hospital. So it was fairly dramatic, and it meant that the final day's worth of action was all cancelled. So,
and notably a lucky escape.
Yeah, so like with the in terms of the way the tournament went, the TD awarded the men's bronze medal to Germany, and then Spain to the fourth place. But it was obviously a lot more interesting on the women's side of the competition, where Spain ended up in the relegation pool, and they needed a point from their final game, or to avoid a narrow defeat against Ireland to avoid relegation, whereas the Irish needed to win to ensure that they stay up in the competition. So it was a fairly fraught situation about how the outcome of this was going to be, and the tournament director sent this one to the EHF, the European Hockey Federation's executive board, to make a ruling on it. And in sort of normal circumstances in the EHF rules, if a team doesn't turn up to play in a game, then there'll be a 5-0 defeat will be recorded against them. But they felt that this was a sort of a force majeure, that it was completely, you know, it wasn't a team not turning up just for the, you know, to, because they didn't want to play. I mean, the Spanish said, look, we will play if you know, forced to, but we only have 9 fit players and things like that. So I think that they took the sensible option not to force them to come to a ground with an infectious disease, an infectious virus. And as a result, what they've decided to do from the EHF board's level is that they're going to extend the size of the competition for 2019. So they've decided there's going to be no relegation. So for both Ireland and Spain, who are both, you know, in the mix for relegation, that neither of them are going to go down a level for the 2019 edition of this competition. And now it remains to be seen whether they're going to do a 9-team competition, or maybe they're going to go to a 10-team competition. They did say in the release that came out earlier this morning that that they're not sure whether it's going to be a 6 or 8-team competition in the division below. So that gives them a bit of scope to actually move two extra teams up from the second tier of the competition, make a 10-team competition. And it's pretty important stuff as well, just in the grander scheme of things, that the 2019 competition is going to be a qualifier for the Junior World Cup in 2020. So as a result of that, for both teams said, we're pretty nervous about the outcome of this, but I think it's kind of a happy enough outcome all around so far.
Yeah, look, it certainly seems like a sensible decision, and it's horrible to decide positions at the whim of administrators or the toss of a coin or whatever way you want to do it. So it's good that there's an opportunity for, I guess, a bit of redemption or otherwise for the teams involved there.
Yeah, and the Irish under 21 coach Dave Passmore is pretty adamant that his side would have gone out and beaten Spain in that. They said he had all his fitness metrics saying that they were improving every game by game and all that kind of stuff, but he doesn't get that chance to prove it now. I mean, there was some talk about maybe having a, you know, bringing the two sides together for a playoff series or something like that. But in the end, I think that you know, you're never going to recreate the same situation with you know, the same level, you know, same players and all that kind of stuff. I mean, for the Irish team, for example, there's a number of them who are on scholarship in the US now who would have to, you know, fly back over for what, one or two games or something like that. It just wasn't feasible to do that. So I think common sense prevails.
Well, we had Sarah and Emma, Emma Buckley and Sarah Toomey on the podcast, and we were rooting the, you know, getting behind the girls there, and we're really winning them on. And we don't know whether we might have a bit of a jinx on people that jump on the podcast, because we had Matt Bird from the WA Thundersticks on 2 weeks ago, and they've missed out on the final four for the finals coming up this weekend. So maybe we should stop interviewing hockey players.
All right. Well, my 3-rock third 11 is going to be jinxed for this weekend. Is that what you're saying?
We were going to ask how your season was going so far.
One game played. We won 10-2, and it wasn't the greatest of spectacles, I suppose, but nice to start with a win.
Well, you can't get the umpires these days, can you?
Did you get on the scoreboard, David?
No, I don't get too far past the halfway line anymore.
Ethan, a 10-2 win.
I'm feeling your pain, Stephen. I've scored about 5 goals in 15 years.
Now, Stephen, we're going to let you go in just a moment. Just one more question, and this is going to come from John, and it's with regard to points or goals.
Look, Stephen, you know, you guys there at the EHL do so much right. I love the television coverage and the competition. You do got a lot of good things. But this point system, it's just got my blood boiling a little bit. I've got to say that, because we don't have points in hockey. We have goals.
Well, you do have points, but you've got to win a game first.
Well, it just strikes me that this is a change that goes to the heart of the game. It's not just an interpretation, and it's something that I find really, really uncomfortable. Can you sell it to me?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I mean, we go the politicians answer and talk about something else first, but the EHL's history is kind of one very, very much based on innovation. You know, since we introduced competition in 2007, it's been the kind of the breeding ground for the self-pass, which has been obviously one of the major highlights in the game, taking the ball over shoulder height and, you know, countdown clocks and various different things like that, and breaking the game into quarters. So, I mean, you know, it is a breeding ground for new ideas and things. And so the competition does really like to try out these things and see if they can improve for the better of the game. And I mean, the idea here is very much to try and promote free flowing attacking hockey, and then maybe encouraging the sides to go more from play rather than going for corners. So that's the basis behind it. And we hope that it does produce more and more field goals.
Yeah, we won't go into it now, because I'm sure I'll just bore our listeners with me repeating myself. But yeah, I'm not happy. As I said, you guys have done a lot of good things for the game, and some of those innovations are fantastic.
Yeah, I look at corners and I see less and less corners being converted, and less drag flicks being of any use to sides. Some of the big boys in drag flicking in Australia just don't seem to be getting any at all at the moment.
Yeah, but and maybe that, you know, I mean, it's from what I see at the moment is you know, taking off the EHL hat is that I think that corner defences are probably getting more fearless and things like that. That some of the running patterns are going more and more direct down the line and kind of closing off big areas of the goal by taking balls on the knee and on the shins and on, in the chest and things like that, and so it's kind of elements like that you know, which are probably at the heart of, you know, maybe why the corner scoring has gone down in that perspective. I mean, I'd be interested to see the statistics when we come to the end of this trial season this year, just to see, you know, whether it does have an impact in terms of, you know, on this small sample size, whether it does have an impact in terms of teams going for more field goals, or whether the corner remains as important to everybody as possible.
So how do you assess that, though? Is it just purely on conversion rate?
Yeah, well, I mean, I assume there's a large number of things you can do. I mean, in terms of, you can look at the conversion rate, or you can look at the volume of corners per game. Again, it's going to be a small sample size. I mean, we have 12 matches this weekend, and then we've got another 16 there at Easter, and then another four for the final four. So, I mean, it is going to be a sample size of 32 games, but whether you see, you know, a reduction in corner counts, and then sort of maybe the nature of the corners that are given, you know, all these kind of things will play into it. And then just in general, you know, whether the key goals in each game, you know, the ones which define it in the last couple, you know, from winning, whether it turns from a winning position to a losing position based on the amount of corner goals as opposed to field goals. So, I mean, I'm sure there's probably some better statisticians and stuff like that who can come up with a better way of judging this. But, I'll wait and see how that plays out.
I've got the statistics for you, Steven. No. Just no.
It'll be zero if you're talking statistics, I think. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, we've got the Hockey India League data there as well, so it'd be interesting to have a look at it. As you know, we're not fans, but we're willing to be sold on a good idea. If it's good for the game.
Yeah, yeah. Not like the bully. Yeah. They should bring that back too, Steven.
And the roll-in from the sideline?
I'm thinking hand stops.
Yeah, hand stops, offsides.
Long corner. Bring the long corner back.
And what's the problem with chucking an undercut from one D to the other? No problem. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. So if people want to catch up with your work on Irish hockey, they can find that at hookhockey.com.
That's it, yeah.
And you take care of all the EHL stuff. Where do we find out more about the Euro Hockey League?
So ehlhockey.tv, and from there you'll get the link to the live stream, which will be going up on Friday.
Now give the Hook a big plug there, Stoven, because it's an excellent website what the hockey club's doing, and the blog's fantastic.
Yeah, well, hookhockey.com is kind of been my baby, basically, just out of you know, it's something I do run in my spare time, but it does take up quite a bit of time. We cover every level of hockey in Ireland, from the EY National League through the underage into pros, all the way down to the school stuff. And we try to be as comprehensive as possible, featuring every team going. And one of the things we're indebted to is our level of photography as well. We've got a brilliant photographer, Adrian Bohm, who basically goes to absolutely everything, and he does it all just for the love of the game. So, you know, it's like probably a lot of different media things around the world in hockey. It's people just do, you know, people with passion making the best of it. And I think it's hopefully serves the Irish hockey public and maybe a little bit beyond.
And where do we get the Three Rock Rovers third 11 reports from?
You might get a quick Twitter update from them there on TRRHC, but as a club we're going great at the moment. We won the EY Champions Trophy last year, which is the kind of end of season playoffs, and the club is actually going to the EHL this year, which is going to kind of test my neutrality quite a bit.
Their games will feature a lot.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't think when it comes to your club, there's no room for neutrality.
Well, that's it. The first team have put together is kind of, they had a great team in 2014, and from the embers of that, about 10 of those players moved on, emigrating, various different things. And then, so the team at the moment, I think it's 13 out of the, or 14 out of last year's squad of 18 at the finals had all come through the youth section of the club. They had an average age of 20. It's, the club coach is formerly the under 16 coach. And he's brought through all those guys through to the first team. So it's a great community kind of local thing that they've put together, rather than in previous years we might have brought in a few too many players, whereas this time it's all very much homegrown. So it's really great to see them having success.
That's what hockey's all about, isn't it? That sort of that club thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Nothing like it.
Stephen, thanks for your time today. Hopefully we can catch up later on in the season and hear some more great stuff from the EHL.
Thanks very much.